Okay, so Parshas Korach, we are going to really just read the first few psukim of the Parsha, and I hope a bit of a new understanding of what exactly is going on in this week's Parsha, and I also hope some practical takeaways as well. Okay, so we're going to analyze the text as we always do. Feel free, you're all on mute, but as always, please feel free to take yourself off of mute at any point to ask questions, to comment. It's deeply appreciated. And with that, let's begin. We're going to begin with a quote from Pirkei Avos. Many people have the custom to be studying Pirkei Avos this time of year, and there is a well-known Mishnah that says, "What is a dispute that is for the sake of heaven? A zohi machlokes shehi l'shem shamayim, zohi machlokes Hillel v'Shamai." That's the dispute between Hillel and Shammai. And what is a machlokes shelo l'shem shamayim? What is a dispute that is not for the sake of heaven? That is the dispute of Korach and his followers. Okay? Now, there is a certain oddity in the text. There's something a little bit off in that text. When you think about it structurally, it's actually not as you would think. It's just two things which are paralleling each other, mirroring each other, or rather contrasting each other. There's something a little bit off in the statement. We're going to come back to that, but that's a framing of what we're going to now begin to study. Okay, so we have the text in front of us. It's both in English and in Hebrew. I hope you're able to see the text. You'll notice there's a lot of colors over here. I wasn't just bored. This is what I do when I have a little bit more time. There's nothing... if you want to appreciate the text and really appreciate the Mefarshim, appreciate the commentators, take an extra moment before, this is what I would normally do, okay? And this is what I was, in the past, I would read a pasuk, okay? And then I would read what the commentators have to say. You miss out on so much, okay? The real way to do this, and this is the way that we're taught to read Gemara as well, is you just read it through. You ask all the questions in the world. You read it with a certain sensitivity, you highlight all the questions, whether figuratively or like I'm doing over here, literally. And then once you recognize all of the pieces which don't seem to fit, all the oddities in the text, then you go to the commentators and it's a whole new world. Then you're actually able to appreciate where they're coming from with their comments. So that's what I have over here. You'll see what my color scheme is in just a moment, okay? But what I'm doing over here and what I did is really highlight different pieces which seem to connote different themes, and you'll see why that's so important in this specific text, okay? So, Vayikach Korach. Korach took. Doesn't tell us what he took, but Rashi suggests that he took people with words. He persuaded, right? Sometimes you could take someone, you could take something physically. Sometimes you could take something emotionally. So Korach took emotionally. He drew along with him. And now who is Korach? We're given some lineage over here. Korach ben Yitzar, he's the son of Yitzar. Ben Kahas, who is the son of Kahas. Ben Levi, who is the son of Levi. Okay? So Korach's taking. Vidasan va'aviram b'nei Eliav, va'on ben Peles b'nei Ruvain. You have Dasan and Aviram, the son of Eliav, the children of Eliav. And you have On, the son of Peles. They are both from the tribe of Ruvain. So whereas already you see something interesting. Korach is introduced with his family lineage, all the way back up to Levi, the head of the ancestor of the tribe. Okay? Dasan, Aviram, On ben Peles. All we know about them is they're part of the tribe of Reuven. Okay? So A, there's a contrast. B, just in general, typically when the Torah describes someone, it's like when you get an Aliyah. They say, Korach ben Yitzar, Halevi. Okay? But you don't normally go Korach ben Yitzar ben Gahas ben Levi. So the fact that it goes this far back already tells you there's something here. And we have to understand why, what function, what reason does the Torah give all this lineage? That would be the first immediate question that should pop out at us, and especially as we contrast that with Dasan and Aviram, who again, all we need to know is that they are the sons of Eliav, or that On is the son of Peles. The fact that they are part of the tribe of Reuven also begs the question, why do we need to know that? Okay, let's come back to that. Ve'yukumu lifnei Moshe, they come before Moshe, they stood before Moshe, okay? And then, v'anashim ibnei Yisrael chamishu masayim. Now we're told, additionally, there are 250 people of the Jewish people. Nisiei Eda Kriei Moed. They are, they are very important people. They are princes. They are people who are part of they're elected people of the assembly. Anche Shem means they are people of renown. Okay? So it's interesting. The structure of this verse is a little bit interesting. It should have put them in the beginning of the pasuk. It said Korach, Dasan, Aviram, On, and the 250 people took and all stood before Moshe. It doesn't say that. It says Korach, Dasan, Aviram, On, and Peles stood in front of Moshe with these people. Right? So already you see there's an interesting bit of a divide. There's some gap over here. It doesn't lump them all together. It kind of separates them out into two groups over here. And that's why I have the first group in red. Okay? And then after it says they stood before Moshe, it's then the other people, the 250 people. And here, interestingly, Vayikahalu al Moshe vel Aharon. Whereas the first group seems to stand in front of Moshe, this group stands in front of Moshe and Aharon. Right? So again, there's a lot going on over here that we would just normally gloss over, okay? Vayomru Alehem, and this group seemingly together says like this, Rav Lachem, it is too much to you. Ki chol ha'eda kulam kedoshim, the entire congregation is holy. Uvisocham Hashem, and among them is Hashem, I'm sorry. Umadua tisnasu al kahal Hashem. Why are you elevating yourselves over the congregation of God? Okay, so that is their argument. Their argument, they all come together and they say, it is too much to you. They turn to Moshe or to Moshe and Aaron and they say, it's too much. The whole congregation is holy. God is among all of them. Why are you, Moshe, Aaron, elevating yourselves over the congregation of God? Okay, for the record, I don't know, you can tell me what you think, but their argument kind of resonates, right? This is a very beautiful point they're making, right? It sounds very appealing, right? They're basically saying, hey, we're all holy. This seems like a very democratic, meritocratic, you know, type of thing. Like, who are you? Why did you just elevate yourself over? We're all close to God. It sounds like such a beautiful, right? If you were just to see this message, you know, actually, there's a funny thing. A little while ago, a few years ago, there was a rabbi from a certain denomination. I'm not going to say any names, but a certain denomination who, in his speech to the graduates of the institution, quoted this pasuk in like a very positive sense. He was saying, "You're all holy. Your God is among you. You know that Kol Eida, this whole group is holy. God is among you." Quoting like the lines of Korach, you know, and it's, you know, it's kind of awkward because he's quoting like the people who clearly were punished. But I also sympathize with him, or you know, because I don't know, it's a beautiful poetic, you know, not poetic, but it's a beautiful uplifting idea. Yeah, God is among you. It's all Kahal Hashem, right? It sounds like a very noble, normal thing to be saying. No? Yes? No? I think so. Okay, so I'm going to go on. Yeah, go ahead. Who's speaking? Oh, it's Bruce.
They didn't elevate themselves. I mean, they were put in that position. They were placed there by God.
Good.
I mean, seems like there's something missing from the argument.
Right. So,
a lack of acknowledgement of God's intervention in this.
Right. So it almost sounds like, I think it's an excellent point. It almost sounds, basically what they're saying is you elevated yourself over, and you're saying, no, God elevated them over. So this argument doesn't make any sense unless you believe that God didn't do that. Right? Which then begs a much bigger question. Wait, what's going on over here? Do these people really not believe in God? Like, after everything? Is their argument, and it's not what they're saying explicitly, but are they saying implicitly that we don't believe that Hashem appointed you? Right? That seems to be the implicit argument, but they're certainly not verbalizing that, right? Last week, we spent a lot of time also reading between the lines, but I think Bruce's point is a very powerful one, and it's an approach that many commentators take. I'm not going to go with that approach today, just letting you know. But it's a very good read in the pasuk, right? The words they're saying are, hey, it's all about equality. Hey, we're all holy. You know, which resonates. But if you read critically what they're saying, ultimately they don't believe that God appointed Moshe and Aaron, right? Which is a pretty serious issue. When we think about it, right? So, okay, but let's hold off on that. It's excellent, excellent points. Vayishma Moshe, let's go to Pasuk Dalid. You know, I'm going to make the font a little bit smaller so you can see it all in the same box at the same time. Will this work? Let's see. No, it's not working. Hold on, a little bit smaller. Hopefully your screens are not too small, and this will work. Okay, let's go. This is so much fun to edit the actual text while we're giving a class. It's the only perk in Zoom. Everything else is terrible, but this is good. Okay, so here we go. Vayishma Moshe vayipol panav. Right? So Moshe hears this. He falls on his face. Okay, what he's doing, discussion for another time. Vayedaber el korach v'kol adaso. Let's see Moshe's response. And also let's see who he's speaking to. So again, there's Korach, there's Dasan, there's Aviram, there's On, there's the 250 people. And seemingly, although it's not abundantly clear, seemingly, and again, there is some ambiguity, they come to Moshe, and then they come to Moshe and Aaron, and then they say, right, we don't even know who says, because there's so many different groups, right? So in the last, in Pasuk Gimel, what did everyone say these words to Moshe, that Rav Lachem, or only some of them said it? We don't know. It's not so clear because there are a bunch of different groups of people that were mentioned. But then Moshe, in his response, he's clearly not speaking to everyone. What does it say? Vayedaber el Korach v'kol adaso lemar. He speaks only to Korach and to his group. Who's missing? Dasan, Aviram, and On. Okay? On, for the record, disappears forever, right? And that's a whole discussion to its own, which we're not going to talk about today. But we will not hear On's name again at all. The Midrashim actually say that his wife saved him. Whatever exactly, you have to read the Midrash carefully. But his wife saved him. Okay. So now Moshe responds to Korach and to his group. And he says, Lamar saying, Boker in the morning, V'yoda Hashem es asher lo. God will, in the morning, God will know whom is his, okay? Vesakadosh, and who is holy. Vikrive lav, God will bring him close to you. Ve'esasher yivchar bo, and whoever he chooses, yakriv elav, he will bring close to him. Zosasu, this is what we're going to do. In other words, Moshe is saying, okay, you're claiming we're not holy? Well, this is what we're going to do to see who God really believes is holy. Okay? And it's interesting that they actually go ahead and listen to him, right? So it seems like, to Bruce's point before, do they believe he has a divine influence or not, right? It's interesting that they take up his challenge. But okay, let's see. Zosasu, this is what we're going to do. Chulachem machdos, Korach v'chaladaso, take pans, Korach and his Ada, his congregation. Usnuvahen eish, place a fire in them. Visimu alehen ketores, and place ketores in them, lefnei Hashem, in front of God, machar tomorrow. V'haya isha sheyivchar Hashem, and whoever God chooses, hu hakadosh, he is holy. Okay? So again, and who's he speaking to? Korach, to his group, seemingly to both of them. But then he says, Rav Lachem b'nei Levi. Too much is to you. Let's see how they translate this. Okay? Rav Lachem is like, you have enough already. Right? Rav Lachem means, Rav is like, from Reboy, there's too much already for you, the children of Levi. You have enough. Did I just freeze? I froze? No? Okay. No? Okay, fine. That's what it sounds like on my side. Okay. Okay, good. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. So, right? So let's just keep that whole discussion. And one thing I just want to ask, one thing which I didn't occur to me until a little while ago, and that is that, okay, why this as the test? Why Ketores? What do we know about Ketores? Very little. You and I, maybe a little bit, but it's such a interesting test. Like, how does Moshe come up with this test? Clearly, this test makes sense to them because they go along with it, right? So one thing we have to ask ourselves is, how does this become the test? There's so many different ways. Why does he just say, whoever, you know, Eliyahu has a better test, you know, Mount Carmel, whoever, everyone's going to bring an offering, and whoever's offering is accepted, that's the one, right? But he doesn't do that. He says, we're all going to bring incense. And whoever's incense are accepted, right? He's the holy one. First of all, what does it even mean? How do we even know whose incense is accepted? It's actually pretty ambiguous. It doesn't even tell us how. But forget that. Why incense? Why is this the test? What is it about incense that this becomes the test? Something we're going to hopefully be able to come back to, but something that we, again, the story's so dramatic, and we all want to get into the floor, you know, dropping from under them, that we kind of, I don't know, we get so excited, we skip some of these important details. Why Ketores? What is the message of the group? And who is this group? There's so much movement over here. There's, you know, again, in the color scheme, we have the red and the blue, and they're going against Moshe. They're going against Moshe and Aaron. Moshe responds, but only to Korach and to his group. Let's keep on reading. Okay? Vayomer Moshe el Korach. Now here, Moshe only speaks to Korach, right? So statement number one, he spoke to Korach and his group. And he said, the test is Ketores. Whoever's holy, God is going to accept. Now Moshe addresses Korach seemingly alone. And he says, Shimu na b'nei Levi, listen, the sons of Levi. Hama'at mikem, is it not enough? Ki hivdil Elokei Yisrael escha me'adas Yisrael. Didn't God already separate you from the congregation of Israel? Lahakriv eschem elav, to bring you close to Him. La'avodas avodas Mishkan Hashem, to do the service of the Mishkan of Hashem. V'lamo lifnei ha'eda l'sharsam, and to stand in front of the congregation to serve them. V'yakriv oschav es kol achacha v'nei Levi itach, and He brought you close, and all of the Levites, all of the B'nai Levi, He brought you close. Uvikashtim gam kahuna, you also want to be Kohanim? Moshe says, Korach. Now he just only to Korach, right? He says, Korach, what's going on over here? You're a Levi. You've already gotten honors. God already gave you so much. You want more? Like, just be happy with what you have. Lachain. Therefore, Ata v'chol adascha hanu adim al Hashem. This is seemingly to Bruce's point. He says, you're not arguing with Aaron. He says, you and your whole group, you are ultimately gathering against God. The Aaron mahu kisalino alav. Why are you arguing against Aaron? In other words, it seems like Korach was saying, I should be the Kohen Gadol. He's saying, why are you arguing against Aaron? It's not about Aaron. Ultimately, you're questioning and you're arguing with God. So his arguments play on two levels. One, he's saying, you have a lot. Relax, okay? You're being greedy, right? That's clearly the first argument. You have so much, why do you want more? The second point he's making is, why are you arguing with Aaron if you believe in God, right? You believe you're supposed to be a Levi. That clearly came from somewhere. So this came from God. Why are you arguing with Aaron? Ultimately, your argument is really against Hashem, okay? Now, phase three, in terms of Moshe's statements and discussions with the people who are rebelling. Vayishlach Moshe likro l'dasan v'laviram b'nei Eliav. Now Moshe goes and sends for Dasan and Aviram, the children of Eliav. Okay? So clearly he hasn't addressed them until this point, right? So again, just to reiterate, we've had two addresses so far. Moshe spoke to Korach and the group, and he gave them this fire pan incense challenge. He then went and spoke to Korach and said, you're being greedy and you're fighting against God. And now he's turning to to Dasan and Aviram. Again, Ohn's disappeared. And Vayomru, and they say, Lo Nale, we're not coming. Okay, so that's our first impression. It's not our first impression. We know already Dasan and Aviram are two troublemakers. But over here we see how brazen they are. They say to Moshe, we don't want to come. And listen, now we're going to listen to what they say. Again, I made this in bold because I want you to contrast that with the statement that was made earlier by the group. The group being either Korach and his 250 people, or all of them together. There they said, we are all holy, let's all, why are you elevating? But let's listen to what Dasan and Aviram say. Hama'at ki alisanu me'eretz zavas chalav udvash. You got to give it to them. This is what they call appropriation, right? This is poetic appropriation. I know that's a buzzword these days, right? But basically, what do they say? They're right, the Zavas Chalav Udvash, of course, is Eretz Yisrael. They say, is it not enough that you took us from a land of milk and honey, flowing of milk and honey, lamisenu bamidbar, to kill us in the desert, ki sisterer alenu gam yisterer, now you want to elevate yourself over us, aflo al eretz zavas chalav udvash haviosanu, you have not brought us to a land flowing with milk and honey, Vatitein lanu nachla sadav acherem, you haven't given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. In other words, you've given us nothing. You've taken us from a lush, amazing country, and you haven't given us anything in exchange. You haven't given us our fields or our vineyards. We are materially lacking. Ha'ene ha'nasha mehem tenaker, if you want to poke our eyes out, lo nala, we're still not going to come out. By the way, just as an aside, maybe a year ago, we spent some time on Parshas Mishpatim speaking about the idea behind slaves going free when their eyes, right, according to Jewish law, when you knock out the eye of a slave, the slave goes free, right? That's an Eved Kanani, right? The Canaanite slave, you knock their eye out, they go free. And we pointed out then that historians have pointed out that actually in the ancient world, knocking out an eye was a way of making someone your slave. It was a way of branding, right? Whose eyes get knocked out? Shimshon, right? There are many esoteric explanations as to why his eyes get knocked out, but the simple, the pshat, is that's what you do to a slave. By knocking out their eyes, it's your way of saying, you're mine, right? So that's actually what they're doing over here, right? And by the way, again, according to Jewish law, what happens? When you knock their eye out, they go free, right? It's such a beautiful thing, right? You're basically saying you cannot own a person. Okay, that's an important tangent right now. But right, Jewish law, yes, it allowed for slavery, but it flipped much of it on its head, and that's just a prime example. In the ancient world, all those damages, you know, knocking out a tooth, knocking out an eye, all those things demonstrated mastery. In Judaism, you do that, and you lose your mastery, because there you're infringing too far into a person's individuality and their independence. Okay, conversation for another time. What happens? What do they say? Vayichar
l'Moshe. Just have a quick thing.
Yeah.
I think we probably should like rethink this whole slavery thing and maybe protest against. You know what I'm saying? Like the Torah saying it's okay, but clearly it's not.
But so you're saying we should protest what? Just want to be clear.
The Torah.
We should protest the Torah. Okay. Yeah. Don't worry. They're protesting the Torah already. Okay, but so that said, slavery is a fascinating and complex issue in Judaism, and one where we have to, I would argue, have to have an open mind and not get lost in apologetics. But Yitzi, if you want to protest the Torah, you got to get in line.
No, I think it's something we should have a conversation about.
I hear you. Probably not the most appropriate time to have a conversation, but maybe it is. Okay. It's a thought. Next week's Parsha?
Silence is silence.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Was there someone else who took themselves off of mute? Nope. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Bruce.
It seems like earlier in the going, it's implied... There's an implied lack of acknowledgement of God's input, and here it's actually stated. I mean, thou hast brought us up. You know, it's so. One is implicit; the other is explicit.
Absolutely.
You know? And this seems much more problematic even yet.
Absolutely, on so many levels. But you're absolutely right. Right earlier on, the other group. It's weird because they're talking about God. They clearly believe in God. The question may be, is Moshe really communicating to God, right? That seems to be part of the question. But over here, you took us out, Moshe. There's nothing to do with God, right? Right. Absolutely. There's absolutely no mention of God. And on the contrary, they're completely blaming it on Moshe. God is not part of the picture at all. We don't know if they believe in anything. We don't know. But we do know that they're upset that this ain't a lush... You know, whatever they had in Mitzrayim, they don't have over here. Okay, so with that in mind, let's try to break this down. The two basic things that I wanted to highlight, most important, are clearly there are different groups over here. Clearly, this is not one monolithic argument, you know, that everyone has the same issue and they're all coming to Moshe with that issue. Just to review, we pointed out that Moshe speaks to three different groups. Moshe, speaks to Korach and his group. Moshe speaks to Korach. Moshe speaks to Korach and the 250 people. And he tells them, you know, we're going to have this test. You want to say we're all coming close to God. We're all equal in the eyes of God. Okay, let's test that out with the Ketores. And we have to answer what's with the Ketores. And then we find Moshe turning to Korach alone and saying, hey, you have enough already. Relax. You're getting greedy. And then you have him addressing Dustin Aviram. He doesn't even get a chance to speak. Then they basically say, hey, we want our flowing milk and honey, and you haven't given it to us. Okay? So clearly, again, just reading the text slowly, there's a lot going on over here, and it's not a simple, he's saying one thing, they're saying something else. Okay? And that's spelled out explicitly by the commentators. We'll start with the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. This is a loose translation. I apologize if it's not a precise one. But he says like this. He says, we must realize and understand, from the entire discussion in the Parsha, from the progression of the disputes and the punishment that befalls them, that Korach, Dasan, and Aviram, and the 250 men were not equal, neither in the terms of their merits, nor regarding the intent behind their struggle. For we see that only Korach and the 250 men, not Dasan and Aviram, participated in the taking of the incense pans. And again, we know why. Because you and I just read it. Because Moshe only mentioned that to them. Dustin and Aviram, as we read carefully, were not even there when that conversation took place. Also, the Almighty dealt with the 250 men honorably, as we will explain, which is interesting, right? How did the 250 men die? Anyone know? It's not by the land opening up. The 250 men die through this divine fire that comes down and consumes them. Okay? So that's interesting, right? We always think about the earth splitting and swallowing everyone. It's not entirely true. It swallows Korach, Dasan, and Aviram, but the 250 men die a different death, right? So, A, from the beginning of the text where we find these different arguments, we find that only 250 men take the Ketores, but also in the punishments, there are major differences. We must therefore understand that the 250 men, listen to this, were actually spiritual giants of Israel in every detail. Where do we see that in the text? Again, if we're going to go back to the text. Okay, I'm sorry. You don't have the text in front of you now, but the text said explicitly that these were Nesi'i Eda, Kriyei Moed, and Anshei Shem. The Torah gives three different terms in describing how special they are. Okay? These are genuinely good people. Okay? They were spiritual giants of Israel in every detail, even in fear of God. And the inaccessibility of the priesthood, which brings closeness and love of God, was like a burning fire inside them. Okay? Their intentions were not for power or imaginary honor, but rather to become sanctified and achieve this level through the avodah, through the sacrificial rituals. So the Netziv argues that the 250 men, we're going to stop there, right? He points out everyone's different. Everyone's in their own box, in their own boat. But the 250 men, he argues, and again, the Torah describes them as very, very special people. And we see in their death that they die through this fire. They are truly, truly desiring to come close to Hashem. They feel limited by the idea of the kahuna, by Levia. They want to come close to God, and that is where their intentions are. Their intentions are good. Their intentions are good. Okay? Sorry?
Oh, I don't know what it is.
Okay. Okay, so let's go further, right? So let's keep on reading. We'll come back to the next group. Let's read the Ramban over here. The Ramban says something very interesting before we get to the other groups, to Korach and Dasan, and Aviram. The Ramban gives a little bit of historical context to what we're reading over here. Says the Ramban, and this is the beginning of the Parsha. Bnei Israel, during their stay in the wilderness of Sinai, experienced no harm. Even, as we pointed out, Even in the instance of the calf, which constituted a grave and well-known sin, the casualties were few, right? Only a few, 3,000 people die out of a large group, right? They were spared through the prayer of Moshe, who pleaded on their behalf for 40 days and 40 nights. They thus loved him as they loved themselves and obeyed him. And if someone had rebelled against Moshe at that time, the nation would have stoned him. In other words, imagine, put yourselves in the Jewish people's shoes as soon as they, at the time that they received the Torah. Moshe has taken them out of bondage after centuries, and he has brought them to our Sinai. They receive a bunch of laws which they accepted. They mess up royally, and Moshe saves them from annihilation. You're going to mess with Moshe? No one's going to tolerate it. No one's going to tolerate it. Korach, therefore, tolerated Aaron's stature, and the firstborn tolerated the stature of the Levium, as well as everything Moshe did. But when they arrived in the wilderness of Paran, okay, so let's pause there for a second. What's he saying? He's saying like this. He's saying that Korach really was upset as soon as this hierarchy was established, right? Immediately Moshe tells them, hey, God says there's going to be Kohanim. Build a Mishkan, and guess what? Only the Kohanim are going to be in the Mishkan. Oh, and all the firstborns, or the people from, all the firstborns, in regular society, you guys are the important ones, not here. It's all going to go to the Levium. Now, presumably, some people were very upset. But Moshe was untouchable. How do you mess with Moshe, right? I mean, lahavdil alfei havdalos, right? To make a major, major distinction. But you read early history of the United States of America, right? And George Washington, right? At some point, there was, already when you start having, Jefferson, you start having some of the divide. They had issues with Washington, but they didn't have a chance. You couldn't criticize Washington. He was holy of holies. He was untouchable, right? So they basically, they blamed other people. You could not mess with Washington. Again, 1 trillion, no comparison on many levels, but again, you couldn't touch Moshe at the early points of history. But when they arrived in the wilderness of Paran, and they were burned, as we read in last week's Parsha, by the fire of Tavera, and many people perished in Kivrot HaTava, and when they sinned in the instant of the scouts, Moshe did not pray for them, and the decree was not annulled, right? God says, they're going to die in the desert, and Moshe accepts that. And the leaders of all the tribes died in a plague before God, right? Who are the spies? They are the princes, and they die, and it was decreed the entire nation would perish in the wilderness and die then. Then the nation's soul was embittered. They felt in their hearts that mishaps would result from Moshe's orders. Korach thus found an opportunity to oppose Moshe's actions, figuring that now the nation will listen to him. You know, the Ramban who's writing this was very well versed in political intrigue, right? He was very involved in politics in his day, right? This is, right, Moshe's ratings, right, at this point, at this juncture, after last week's Parsha, you know, they plummeted. His popularity plummeted. And so if there's ever a time that you want to go ahead and push back, it's now. So the Ramban, and I think it's just a fascinating insight, right? Because what happened over here? Nothing happened. All these appointments took place a year ago. But what happened is that the Jewish people started to get burnt, literally. And they're suffering, and they feel like Moshe doesn't have their back to the same extent. Korach, who is an opportunist, comes along and says, well, I've been bothered all the time, right? And he spells this out over here. Let's keep on reading the Ramban right now. He spells it out. Korach was angered by the appointment of Elitzaphan as leader over the Levite family of Kehas, as our sages say, and he envied Aaron too, as it says, and you seek priesthood as well. Okay, so I'm not going to get into all the details right now, but if you remember when we introduced Korach, we're introduced that he's the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kehas, the son of Levi. And it gives us the whole family tree. And the reason is because the Torah wants to highlight that Korach really came from a family which is higher than Elitzaphan. Okay, we're not going to get into all the family tree, and if I have a family tree, but basically, Korach feels that he got stiffed in the appointments. Not only he feels he got passed over in terms of hierarchy of age, and in general he's jealous, he feels like the family of Kehas is special, but Korach again is a cousin of Moshe, right? He's part of the family. And he's saying that I should get more, I should become the leader of my tribe, and more than that, he's jealous of Aaron as well. These jealousies were always there. He just never had a sympathetic ear until now. Because now he sees the people are getting upset, and therefore he knows now is the time I could go ahead and fight, right? And I might be able to be successful. So let's just review quickly. The Netziv is saying the 250 men, that's not jealousy. They are truly envious of Aaron because they want so badly to come close to God, and they feel like all this idea of Leviah, Kahuna, all that's getting in the way. We just want God, right? They're very pure. They might be wrong, but it's very pure. Korach is a jealous person who waits for a good opportunity, and then he comes in and he starts fighting against Moshe. But really, this is long-standing. He wants the kahuna. He wants to be like Aaron. It's coming from a place of jealousy. What about Dasan and Aviram? So the Malbim suggests that Dasan and Aviram, where's their argument? Their argument is that what tribe are they from? Remember? They're from the tribe, they're from B'nai Reuven. They are from the tribe of Reuven. So he suggests that Dasan and Aviram, their argument is that Reuven being the firstborn, right? Reuven is the firstborn of Jacob, of Yaakov. Therefore, our family should be the priests. And their argument is that we also should be priests. That's what the Malbim suggests, and that's why the Torah tells us that they are from the tribe of Reuven. Now, the challenge to this approach, which is a popular approach, is doesn't match up with what they say, right? In their argument to Moshe, it has nothing to do with anything. What their main argument seems to be, again, if you look at verse 14, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor did you give us an inheritance of fields and vineyards, right? It seems like they're not arguing about priesthood. It seems like it's something else entirely. And so I want to share with you a new approach, a different approach, I should say. It's not my own. It's an approach from Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein. He is one of the deans of the Gush Yeshiva. His father was the famous Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And he says like this. He says like this. Let's just do a quick review and then we'll take it a little bit further. Korach, as the Ramban stated, is simply jealous and he's taking advantage of a weak moment for Moshe. Okay? Now, the Ramban pointed out things are starting to spiral downward. We actually spoke about that last week. As soon as Jethro, as soon as Yisro leaves, everything starts to fall apart. So there is a crisis going on with the Jewish people. The Jewish people, right? And let's go a little bit deeper. Where is this crisis coming from? What are the issues that the Jewish people start, as soon as, again, not last week, but 2 weeks ago, the Jewish people start complaining. What are they interested in? What are they asking for? You remember? As soon as Yisro leaves, what are the Jewish people asking for? What are they begging for? Anyone know? They're asking for meat. Okay, I don't know about you, back when I went to sleepaway camp, we want food, right? That's basically what they were saying. They were basically chanting, we want food. We want meat. We want more of the good, you know, the material good. Suggest Rav Lichtenstein, Korach is an opportunist. He doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of what they're complaining about. People are complaining. People are unhappy, as the Ramban said. Korach steps in. But then he suggests that the 250 men, those holy ones, as the Netziv told us, and Dasan and Aviram, see the exact same thing, the exact same issue, and they go in two very different directions. Okay? What happens? Okay? Like this. The 250 men, well, you know what? Let's start with Dasan and Aviram. Dasan and Aviram, if you think about it, are just taking the argument that we saw 2 weeks ago in the Torah portion, where the Jewish people are now demanding more meat. They're acting more hedonistic. Dasan and Aviram are saying, and it's more than that. It's not just that we want meat and we want to keep on going in that direction. We want a land flowing with milk and honey that you haven't given us. In other words, they see Dasan and Aviram are actually quite intelligent, and we don't give them credit for that. Korach just sees unrest. I want to be super clear over here. Korach sees political unrest and takes advantage. There's chaos. I'm going to step in because I want an opportunity and Moshe is not popular right now. His ratings are down. It's my chance. Dasan and Aviram are much, much, much more attuned to the needs of the people. He sees them demanding meat. They see them, demanding more meat. They see them demanding more pleasures of the world. Dasan and Aviram take that as their flag. They say, we want meat. We want Mitzrayim. We want Egypt with all of its hedonistic pleasures. That's what we want, right? They're listening to what the people are saying and they're taking it one step further. They see that the people are not acting so spiritual right now and they say, good, we're going to have a new banner. This Torah thing, not working, right? As Bruce points out, there's no acknowledgement of God whatsoever because that's not important to Dasan and Aviram. It's not about God whatsoever. What they see is they see that the people are turning a bit of a corner in a negative way and they are moving away from this more spiritual, more godly approach and they say, you know what? We're going to take that even further. We want to go back to a place like Egypt. We want to live a more hedonistic life. Rally around us. That's the argument that Dasan and Aviram make. The 250 people, they are going in the exact opposite direction. They also see a decline in the people. They also see how the people are now demanding meat and demanding more hedonistic things. But these 250 people, they aren't hedonists like Dasan and Aviram. On the contrary, they're holy people. And they say, you know, Moshe and Aaron, you know what's happening over here? You know why the people are clamoring for meat? It's because this philosophy, this Jewish philosophy, Yahadut, you know, the Torah that you're presenting to them is doing them a disservice. Think about it. You're creating these barriers, this idea that only the Kohen comes close, and then the Levi, and then it's us. Right? There's so much separation between us and God. What's with all these barriers? We don't need barriers. We want to just connect to God directly. Me as an individual, me and my soul, I want to connect to God directly. And more than that, suggests Rav Lichtenstein that the 250 people are arguing. What they're arguing is that this whole notion of any physicality, right? The notion that you're a Kohen family, right? Let's think about this. The notion that there are Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, that is a physical breakdown. That's DNA. That's your parents were different than my parents. But if we live in a world of souls, if we live in a world of spirituality, there's no difference between a Levi and a Kohen. Internally, we're all the same. It doesn't matter who our parents are. If I'm just looking at the soul, there is no physical world, right? These 250 people were arguing. It's, you know why the people are falling apart? It's because of all these barriers that you've created. The whole religion is created around barriers. A, there's this Mishkan where only some people could come into. The tabernacle is limited. It's off limits to everyone else. And then there's this notion of sacrifice where we're taking animals and we're elevating the physical world. It's not a good idea. There's all this embracing of the physical world. That, they argue, is why the people are going off the rails. We need to move away from the physical world entirely. We need to go in a completely spiritual direction. It's a very creative read, but it's elegant. Listen to what's happening. Again, the people are demanding more meat. The people are clearly falling apart a little bit spiritually. Dustin Aviram says, good, let's run with that. Let's go even further to hedonism. The 250 people say, we see it, it's a problem. It's because Judaism demands this delicate dance between the physical world and the spiritual world. Let's move to asceticism. Let's go completely away from that all, and let's go serve God without any barriers. Spirituality alone. And when you think about it, what is the most spiritual of services in the Mishkan? And let's think of, anyone want to take a guess? What does that even mean? Maybe I have to define my question. What is the most spiritual, you know what the most spiritual service in the temple is? It's the ketores. It's the incense. And this is something the mystics speak about a lot. You know, I'll speak personally. I have a terrible sense of smell. Terrible sense of smell, right? And I remember just speaking to my children the other day. My son was saying how he smelled this amazing smell. I said, you know, I don't smell. He felt bad that I can't smell it so well. I said, you know, truth is, out of all the senses, if there's one that I really don't care about, not don't care about, but if there's one that could be a little weaker than the rest, I'll take smell, right? I it's important to see. I need to see. I want to be able to taste, and of course, taste and smell are related. But I need to be able to hear. You know, smell. What is smell, right? And the mystics actually say that smell is a messianic, it's a sense that's not part of this world. It's always associated with all messianic things. You know, Purim, there's a lot of, you know, Mordechai, Mor, Doror, his name is associated with the Ketores, with the incense. It's all future world, because smell, there's nothing, right? The menorah, you light a light, it provides light, right? It's something you can now see in the room. The bread, the showbread, you could eat it, right? But smell, okay, it's like air. What is it? It's nothing. You don't see it. It's there, right? So smell is actually always associated with asceticism. And let's think about it. Who in the Torah brings ketores? When's the last time we had ketores? Nadav and Avihu, right? The children of Aaron. And there it's clear that these are two ascetics. They are two people. They don't get married, right? They don't want to have anything to do with the physical world. They're all about, it's just about God. We just want to be connected to God, right? That's why they bring incense. And parenthetically, how do they die? They die from a fire of God. They basically went too close. They got burnt. And that's exactly how these 250 people die. They die from this fire of God. What happened to them is that they went too close, just like Nadav and Avihu went too close. Their philosophy was, let's move away from the physical world. We see things falling apart. Let's move away from the physical world. Let's go to spirituality. That will save the people. And Moshe says, well, let's try it. Bring ketores, right? That's why he tells them to bring the ketores, because that is the offering of an ascetic. That is the offering that says the physical world is nothing. But ultimately, clearly, they are wrong, right? So let's just summarize before we take this one tiny step further, right? So again, things are falling apart. The people, on many levels, the people clearly are clamoring for more physicality, for more hedonism. They want more meat. You know, the commentators say they're actually quite upset at some of the sexual restrictions, if you read between the lines in their initial complaints 2 weeks ago. And then Shlach comes along and the Jewish people are condemned to dying in the desert. Korach is an opportunist. He is just jealous. He wants to be the high priest. And he comes along and says, I want to be the high priest. He cloaks it in this very noble argument, but basically he's jealous. He's just waiting for a good opportunity. And he comes along and he brings this, you know, and he joins forces with all these other people, ultimately because of his jealousy. The other groups are much more attuned politically to the masses. They recognize something's falling apart. Dasan and Aviram say, okay, well, therefore, let's go ahead and take that even further. Let's start a new Judaism. It's a Judaism, we're not serving God, we're serving ourselves. It's all about a land flowing with milk and honey. God, who's that? And therefore, they want to take the Jewish people's downward spiral and make it a philosophy, make it something to embrace. And the 250 people, the Anshei Shem, these very spiritual people, say the exact opposite. Yes, things are falling apart spiritually. It's because Judaism has too much of an embrace of the physical world. The notion of a caste system, that some people's family, your birth, who you come from, your mother, your father, the notion of karbanot, of offerings, all of that is too much engagement in the physical world. Let's move to a world of ketores, of incense, of pure spirituality. Let's move to a world where there are no barriers. Everyone is close to God. That's their argument. Now, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable when you think about it now, right? What's happening is that... Actually, I'm going to pause on that statement. Just as an aside, how they die is so appropriate now, right? The two, Korach and Dasan and Aviram, their argument was very much a worldly, physical, material argument. Dasan and Aviram literally was a hedonistic argument. Korach was all about his vanity. They die by the earth. The 250 people, they were spiritual. They die by this heavenly fire. Right? It matches up perfectly, right? In the sense that some die by the ground, and that is because their argument is much more of an earthly type of argument, whereas there is the punishment from God, literally from God's fire, from the heavens, that is the people who tried coming too close to God from a very different perspective. But what is amazing over here is that you have three groups. You have the rebellion of Korach, but if you start to unravel their different arguments... Let's say they would win. Let's play that game, right? There's all these movies these days, right? With all these possibilities. You know, if Germany would have won the war, right? Whatever, all these different possibilities. Let's say they would have won. Okay, next day, Moshe is put into chains and they send him off to Midian. Okay, next day. So now Korach, Dasan, Aviram, 250 people sit down and they say, "What are we doing today?" Korach puts on the vestments of the Kohen Gadol. He says, "Well, I'm going to, you know, bring the karbanos and I'm the high priest." The 250 people look at him and say, "What are you talking about? We're dismantling the Mishkan. There are no priests. There are no karbanos." Dasan and Aviram are saying, "Why do you guys keep on saying Baruch Hashem? We're trying to eat meat over here and have pleasure, right?" They're all fighting against the same person, but they would all end up fighting against each other the next day. There's nothing holding them together other than their hate for Moshe, right? But when you start to pick apart at their arguments, they actually, there's nothing holding them together whatsoever except for a common enemy, right? And if you remember, what did Pirkei Avos say? Let's go back to that quote for a second, right? What does the Mishnah in Avos say? Let's see, where are we? Here we are. What is a dispute for the sake of heaven? The dispute of Hillel and Shammai, right? Because Hillel is arguing with Shammai. What is the dispute not for the sake of heaven? It should say the dispute of Korach and who is he arguing with? Just like Hillel and Shammai, Korach and Moshe, or Korach and his followers and Dasan and Moshe and Aaron. Instead it says Korach and his followers. You know why? We know why now. Yeah, right? You understand the question? It should say the two disputants, right? Hillel and Shammai, Korach and his followers, and Moshe and Aaron. But it says Korach and his followers, because they're arguing with each other. Although they're saying, "Hey, Moshe," but really when you start to pick apart at their actual arguments, the only thing that united them was a common enemy, but they themselves had nothing. They themselves were also arguing with one another, right? And this is so incredibly common when you have, when we have people arguing and fighting, and when you have disputes in communities or whatever, so often... Right? What's happening is that there's this incredible excitement. Korach is the populist. Korach is the one who's able to rally everyone's attention and everyone's energy. And he's able to get everyone this common enemy. But in actuality, what's happening is that, right, we're so quick to attack, right? Everyone follows Korach, but they're not even thinking about what they're arguing about. They're not even coming together in any common ground whatsoever. They're just coming to fight against the common enemy, but they're so quick to take down, to cancel, whatever. Right? That when we dig a little bit, when we ask a little questions, when we analyze, it doesn't add up. there are these incredible inconsistencies. And when we think about it, what we really have is an argument between Korach and his 250 followers and Dathan and Avira. There is no common thread holding them together. And it is the danger, right? There's something so appealing about, you know, the exciting populist, you know, to overthrow whatever it is that is the status quo. And it's just sometimes important when we find ourselves in arguments. Forget it, let's not make this so global. Ourselves in arguments, right? What exactly are we arguing about? What exactly is our cause? Are we actually fighting for a coherent cause? Or is it, like Korach, is it about myself? Is it about my own vanity? Is it about my own jealousy, right? There's so much here that is relevant to the common causes that we find ourselves swept up in, whether it's on a personal level or beyond that. The questions of, what are we really fighting for? Do we have a common cause? Or do we just have a common enemy? And I think the important message from Korach as well, this question of, is it about me or is it really about my cause? And another important question we have to ask ourselves. Ultimately, I think the when we move beyond the practical, but I think if we talk about this from a philosophical perspective, if we were to take the arguments, again, of Dathan and Aviram, and that of the 250 men, what we have over here, by contrasting with them, is what Judaism stands for. Dathan and Aviram are saying, let's pull ourselves to this physical world and become more hedonistic. The others are arguing, let's become so removed from this world. And ultimately, Judaism does attempt to play this delicate, attempts to dance this delicate dance. And tries to, on the one hand, engage the physical world, acknowledge the physical world, acknowledge the fact that there are differences within one another, that there is something called a Kohen, there is something called a Levi, there's something called a Jew, there's something called a non-Jew. There are these physical differences which we acknowledge. We look at the world with physical eyes, and yet we try to balance that and integrate that with spirituality. We don't live the world of Ketores, nor do we live the world of pure hedonism. We live this attempted balance, trying to navigate the physical and spiritual, trying to bring them together in a beautiful harmony. Thank you for joining me. I hope you all have a fabulous Shabbos. And again, most of what I just said is based on Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, a brilliant, brilliant scholar. You should read more of his stuff. He's just awesome. And good Shabbos, everyone. So nice to see you all. And hope to see